Anatomy and Physiology, the Spinal Cord and Spinal Nerves, Part 2. Remember last time we talked about the spinal nerves and we barely got them out of the bony vertebral column. But remember, these are thousands and thousands of axons that are heading somewhere to do something. So that's what we have to talk about next. Down to your left in the figure is a bony vertebrae. It shows a nice cross-section of the spinal cord and then a pair of spinal nerves in yellow emerging from the bony vertebral column. So let's go ahead and talk about this at some length. Please remember there are 31 pairs of spinal nerves that shoot out of the spinal cord. Spinal nerves are mixed nerves. That's important. Remember what that means. They are both motor and sensory in their function. So whether we talk about it or not on the spinal nerves coming up, remember there are both motor and sensory functions of these nerves. The nerves emerge from the bony vertebral column through a hole called the intervertebral foramen, which just means the in-between the vertebrae hole. What happens after that? Well, the spinal nerves start to divide into branches. Another name for branches is called rami. They're used interchangeably. What I usually do at this point in time is I stand up. I stick my arms straight out of my body, and they represent the big spinal nerves coming out of the spinal cord. And then I spread my fingers out, except I pretend I only have four fingers, because there are four major branches you have to know. The first branch, which I'll highlight with an arrow, is a branch called the meningeal branches. It's hard to see in your book's picture, but they do something funny. They make kind of a loop-de-loop, a hairpin turn, and they go back in. And they supply the meninges, like the name says, the vertebrae, and the blood vessels of the spinal cord. Another branch, which I'll highlight with a red arrow, is called the rami communicantes. It just means the branch that communicates. But with what? They supply the autonomic nervous system. And what should immediately roll off the tip of your tongue is they go to smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands. The next branch is called the posterior or the dorsal rami. They only go to a small strip of skin and muscle that kind of runs right up and down the middle of your back. In other words, they don't really do a whole lot. And then, the granddaddy of them all. I kind of make this my thumb when I'm standing up and demonstrating this to the class. And my thumb is real big, and the anterior branches are real big. And look where the anterior rami, or the ventral rami, go. They go to the anterior trunk and to all the limbs with double stars. What does that really mean to you? What should you write off to the side? It means the anterior branches of our spinal nerves pretty much go everywhere else, don't they? And that's mostly what we'll be talking about on the up-and-coming slides. But let me ask you questions on this slide, like I like to ask on the test. A little bit of thinking involved here. Your patient has an ice pick injury. The ice pick goes through the rami communicantes. What problems will your patient have? Feeling a strip of skin up their back, moving their arm, or beating their heart? And the correct answer would be beating their heart. Next question. A bullet has lacerated some posterior rami. What problems will your patient have? Feeling a strip of skin up their back, beating their heart, or moving their legs? And the answer is feeling the strip of skin up the middle of their back. Finally, I take a pair of scissors on the test and I clip some anterior rami. What problems will your patient have? Feeling a strip of skin up their back, beating their heart, or moving and feeling their limbs? And the correct answer, of course, would be moving and feeling their limbs. So that's the way I like to ask it on a test. It just asks you to do a little bit of extra thinking. Let's start with this slide called the intercostal nerves. And I love the name. It really tells you where they are. Inter means in between. Costal means ribs. They're the in-between the ribs nerves. What are they? They are the anterior branches of spinal nerves, T2 through T12. Again, called intercostal nerves, or there's a synonym that my friends sometimes use on the weekends called thoracic nerves. Notice in this posterior view that your book uses for a figure, these nerves go in a straight shot directly from point A to point B. They go straight in between the ribs, and they supply the skin and the muscle between the ribs. They do not form what we call plexuses. If you looked ahead, which again I hope is everybody, all the other anterior branches of the spinal nerves form these lacy, networky plexuses. But that doesn't happen here. They go straight from one point to another. Again, they innervate. That means they supply the intercostal spaces. Also, the bottom half of these nerves, T7 through T12, give some supply to the abdominal wall as well. Where will you see these involved in the real world? I'll give you an example. I saw a patient one time had a stab wound to the chest. They had a collapsed lung on that side. The treatment is to place a chest tube in. What the chest tube does, basically, is after you insert it, it is hooked up to suction and it helps to reinflate the lung. So I'm doing my first chest tube, and the patient comes in, and they're obviously struggling to breathe, but I'm trying to be real sympathetic and empathetic with the patient, so I'm trying to numb this area up right here, and I'm using some lidocaine, and I'm not getting him very numb, and he's writhing in pain. And the attending physician says, "What are you doing? The patient is dying. You don't have time to totally numb them up. Shove the chest tube in and save their life." And the chest tube is a big plastic tube about big around as your thumb. And I'll tell you what, if you've ever seen one done or participate on one, when you put that tube in between their ribs, you'll know all about the intercostal nerves because, boy, you'll rake across them and that patient will be in some significant discomfort while you're placing the tube. Most people's memories of a chest tube, if they've ever seen one or done one, is that the patient was in a lot of pain during the procedure. But you don't have time to numb up. You got to save their life. And to do that, you got to put the tube in, hook it up to that suction, and reinflate their lungs. Next, we'll talk about the spinal nerve plexuses. And the anterior rami of most all other spinal nerves do not go in a straight shot from one point to another. They instead join to form these lacy, spiderwebby-looking networks called plexuses. Here's a drawing over to your left, a figure from your book showing a plexus from the neck. It's showing how the anterior branches in yellow of these spinal nerves start to intermingle and form this green network called the plexus. Why that happens in the body, I've never read what's really a good explanation for me anyway. Some people have suggested it kind of builds redundancy or protection into the system. I guess that kind of makes sense. But overall, we're just going to have to accept it, guys. I wish that all nerves just went directly from one place straight to another, but most of our anterior branches form networks. There's four major networks we'll look at. There is a plexus in the neck, conveniently called the cervical plexus. There's one for the upper limb region called the brachial plexus. one in the lower back region called the lumbar plexus, and one right around the sacrum that some genius called the sacral plexus. We're going to take a look at those plexuses one at a time, and then what we're going to do is we're only going to pick a couple of nerves that emerge from the plexus. We're going to name them, and we're going to learn their functions. Let's start with the cervical plexus. These slides are all organized the same way so that both you and I could stay focused and stay organized while we're studying. First, I tell what anterior branches form the plexus. Then I talk about what general area of the body is supplied by the plexus. Then I pick off a couple of my favorite nerves, and we learn their names and their functions. So here we go. The cervical plexus is formed by the anterior branches of spinal nerves C1 through C5. What do they supply? Well, they supply where they are. That's the big picture. I mean, here's a plexus or a network of nerves in your neck, and they supply where they are. They supply the head. They supply the neck. They supply the shoulders. That's where they are. There's only one exception to the rule here, and I got a big red star on it. There is one nerve that does come out of the plexus that wiggles way on down towards your belly, and it supplies the diaphragm. So that's kind of the odd man out. Otherwise, it supplies where it is. The only nerve out of all these nerves I want you to know is the phrenic nerve. The phrenic nerve is the nerve that goes to the diaphragm. The phrenic nerve, I want you to know, receives axons from, receives contributions from segments C3 through C5. And they taught me a rhyme in med school. They said C3 through C5 keeps the diaphragm alive. And that's a good thing to know, because unfortunately, you'll see spinal cord injuries. I hated to see them because they're so devastating for everybody, but they happen. And you need to know that a high spinal cord injury, one that damages the cord above C3, will cause respiratory arrest. I will show it to you on the PowerPoint. I've animated it. Here comes a red line right across. Let's say we transected the spinal cord superior to C3. Well, if we do that, then no impulses from the brain can come down from all our breathing centers and make it to these wires that supply the diaphragm. So high spinal cord injuries cause paralysis of the diaphragm, respiratory arrest, and the patient ends up, unfortunately, on the ventilator. Always reminds me of a famous person years ago, an actor, Christopher Reeve, played Superman in the movies. And he fell off a horse, I believe it was. He had a high neck injury, presumably above C3, and he ended up on the ventilator before he passed away. Next comes the brachial plexus. You need to be able to tell me that the brachial plexus is formed by contributions from the anterior branches of spinal nerves, C5 through T1. Where is it located? Look at this and circle it. Notice this plexus has to pass between the first rib and the clavicle before it finally enters the armpit. And I want to stop right here because that is important. That space is kind of tight. I'm going to do something that, of course, I don't want you to do. I'm going to stick my index finger between my clavicle and my first rib. Then I'm going to raise my arm over my head. And as I do that, I'm actually feeling pressure and pinching on my finger. When I take my finger away, I actually feel pain in my shoulder. Don't do that. I'm just saying that as an example. Because that plexus passes through there, and it's easy to damage it as it passes through that tight space. After the plexus passes through the axilla, it enters the shoulders and upper limbs, where it supplies both motor and sensory function. This reminds me of some common areas where you may see this injured. One of them is on the playground. I used to not like to see this. Usually a mother would be out there with her youngster, little kitty, grab her child by the arms and swing the baby by the arms round and round and round and round. I'm thinking, no, please don't do that, because I'm thinking as they're stretching out the arms, they're stretching out that plexus and maybe pinching it between the clavicle and the first rib. And yes, it's possible to have either temporary or permanent paralysis due to damage to the plexus by doing that. So, no swinging babies over your heads. Another place where you might see it, I hope you don't, but it happens, is during delivery while you're rotating through the OBGYN floors. So I'll circle, for example, let's say this is the baby's head. And let's say you pull the baby's head out. And then the shoulder gets hung up in the birth canal. So you start yanking the head this way, but the shoulder's stuck. So the shoulder's kind of going this way while you're yanking the head this way. And while you're doing that, you're actually overstretching the brachial plexus. And yes, sometimes during childbirth, during traumatic delivery, so to speak, the brachial plexus gets injured, and those babies can have either temporary or permanent paralysis of the upper extremities for that reason. Okay, I know this slide looks really busy. Here is a right upper extremity showing the brachial plexus, and then a whole bunch of nerves that come out of it. Looks like 8 million nerves. I'm only going to pick 4 nerves that shoot out of the plexus that you have to know by name and their function. I've got a red star next to both of them, or next to all of them, excuse me, if you want to try to find them. And don't worry, I'm not going to show you this map on the test. You're not going to have to pick them off. The first nerve I want you to know that emerges from the brachial plexus is the musculocutaneous nerve. Look what it does. It does the flexors of the arm, that's where your biceps is, and the flexors of your forearm. Remember, that's down lower where your radius and ulna are. So in front of the class, what I normally do is I flex my muscles like bodybuilders do. And that demonstrates the musculocutaneous nerve. So make a muscle with the musculocutaneous nerve. Second, I want you to know the radial nerve. Look at what the radial nerve does. Just the opposite. It does the extensors of both the arm and the forearm. Usually in front of the class, I then straighten my arms back out. I put it up this way on the slide on purpose to help my pea brain remember it, because it spells MR, right? MR for Mr. And so I just remember Mr. Muscle. And when I say Mr. Muscle, for the M, I flex my arms, and for the R, I extend my arms. So just picture someone doing that. Mr. Muscle, MR, flex, extend. The other nerve I want you to know is called the median nerve. The median nerve does some flexors of the forearm, but also of the lateral hand muscles and the lateral hand skin. Let's stop right there, because we have to remember our anatomical position. If you stand in normal anatomical position, what is the lateral part of your hand? That's the part of your hand with your thumb on it, right? So how do I remember that the median nerve goes to the lateral part of my hand? You see where I'm coming from? I remember it this way. The median nerve goes to the meaty part of my hand, the meaty part of my palm. You know, right next to your thumb, there's a pretty meaty muscle there. So the median nerve goes to the meaty part of my palm. Then comes the ulnar nerve. the ulnar nerve does, again, some of the flexors of the forearm and most of the hand muscles and medial hand skin. In anatomical position, what part of the hand is medial? That's on the pinky side of the hand. So I'm not immune to going to third grade bathroom humor to remember some of this stuff. That's the way you'll never forget that the ulnar nerve goes to the pinky side of the palm. Just remember PU. I got some more for you because there's a lot on this slide and we need some more memorization techniques. So I remember I have an M here and I have a U here. And MU spells moo, like a cow goes moo. So I picture myself holding a cow in my hand. Now, it's not a real cow. It's like a toy cow, a plastic toy cow that my son has at home. And I take that cow in my hand and I flex it. And I just remember cow goes moo, right? And MU stands for the median and ulnar nerve, and the median and ulnar nerve allow me to flex my hand. So flex a cow in your hand, cow goes moo, and you'll remember median and ulnar nerve, flex your hand. That reminds me of a true story. A few years back, I was teaching my son the animal sounds. And we have some plastic animals at home. And I held up the animal, and like I had a duck. I said, how does a duck go? He says, quack, quack. I says, how does a pig go? And I show him a little plastic pig, and he goes, oink, oink. And then I showed him my little plastic cow that I have. I said, how does a cow go? And he said, eat more chicken. And I just hit the floor cracking up. Those were the first words out of his mouth. And it's because, of course, his mother takes him to Chick-fil-A way too often. Anyway, I've got even more to help you remember this stuff, right? We got Mr. Muscle for the musculocutaneous and the radial. And now to tie together everything we just talked about on the median and ulnar nerve, all you have to remember is moo-poo. Moo-poo. I know, third grade bathroom humor, but it helps you remember location and function of the median and ulnar nerves. This also reminds me to talk to you about something you may have heard called the funny bone. We really don't have a funny bone, but we do have a funny nerve, and it happens to be the ulnar nerve. The ulnar nerve runs through a notch behind the ulna. And sometimes we accidentally bang that nerve, like down on a table. Don't do it. I don't want you to get any nerve damage. But next time you do bang that ulnar nerve by accident, you'll notice some funny tingling sensation running down the medial part of your forearm, the medial part or the pinky part of your hand, and it'll split down right down the middle of your ring finger, and only do the medial one half of the ring finger will be tingling. So notice that the next time you accidentally ding your ulnar nerve, and then you will forever remember the distribution of the ulnar nerve perfectly. So let's talk about the only two nerves that I want you to know specifically that emerge from the lumbar plexus. Over to your left, a figure from your book shows an anterior view of the right lower limb and a posterior view. Here is the femoral nerve and here is the obturator nerve. Let's talk about the femoral nerve first. Injury to the femoral nerve will cause inability to flex the thigh at the hip and extend the leg at the knee. It will also cause loss of sensation in the anterior and medial thigh. Because please remember, these are mixed nerves, whether we talk about it or not. But how do I remember this in case on a test I give you a question about the femoral nerve, or maybe I'll cut the femoral nerve on the test? I just remember the femoral nerve is the football kicking nerve. Think about kicking a football. What do? You flex your thigh at your hip, then you extend your leg at your knee. So it's easy. Femoral nerve is the football kicking nerve. Next comes the obturator nerve. Injury to the obturator nerve will paralyze the thigh adductors. Remember, ADD duct means to draw towards the midline. That moves the thighs inwards. So I just remember the obturator nerve operates the thigh adductors, kind of like operating a thigh master, I guess. Also, injury to the obturator nerve may cause loss of sensation over the medial thigh as well. I'll give you an example where you might see this involved in real life. During pregnancy, the baby's bony skull is lodged, it's wedged in the woman's bony pelvis, and sometimes that head puts pressure on the obturator nerve. It might bruise it or crush it. And that can lead to either temporary or sometimes permanent paralysis of the thigh adductors. And that may be the reason sometimes you see a pregnant woman walking kind of funny. You know, people say the pregnant waddle or whatever, but, you know, don't make fun of them. They might have nerve damage. The sacral plexus is the last plexus we'll talk about. Once again, you need to know it is formed by the anterior branches of spinal nerves, L4 through S4. That's a huge plexus. Look at all the spinal nerves that contribute to this network. Where is it located? Right anterior to the sacrum. And what does it supply? Well, it supplies where it is. It supplies the buttocks. It supplies the perineum and most of the lower limb. For those of you who don't know what the perineum is, it's a good time to pencil it in right now. The perineum basically is the area between the thighs. There's only one nerve I want you to know that comes out of the sacral plexus. It is the sciatic nerve. It is the largest nerve in the body. You may have seen it in the cat dissection when you filleted open the hammies. It was that big, white, shiny nerve. It receives contributions, axons, from spinal nerves L4 through S3. In other words, almost the entire sacral plexus is contributing to form this humongous nerve called the sciatic nerve. What does it supply? The posterior thigh, also pretty much the entire leg and foot, both sensory and motor. The sciatic nerve actually is a combination of two nerves. You may have seen this if you were lucky in lab. The two parts are the tibial nerve, which runs right behind the tibia, and then there's another nerve that runs along the fibula called the common fibular nerve, which most of my friends just call the fibular nerve. Usually they split behind the knee. And some of you may have seen that split on the kitty cat in lab behind the knee. Here's a decent figure from your book, again showing the right lower limb, both an anterior and a posterior view. Let's look at the posterior view. Here comes the big sciatic nerve and then the split behind the knee. One half of it going behind the tibia that some genius called the tibial nerve, and one half of it going around the fibula that some rocket scientist called the fibular nerve. Let's talk about this in more detail because you're going to see people with sciatic nerve injuries. Sciatic nerve injuries are common. And people who have sciatic pain, also called sciatica, will tell you they feel the pain going down the buttocks, down the back of the thigh, all the way through the leg, and down to the foot. And it's extremely annoying. There are different causes for it. Sometimes it could be a herniated disc that is squashing on the nerve. But there's other things I want you to know that can cause sciatic pain. I'll use pregnancy again as another example. Sometimes the baby's head, again, will be pressing so hard in the pelvic region that it will crush on the sciatic nerve. And again, pregnant women may have trouble with numbness, tingling, weakness, paralysis of their lower limb because of sciatic nerve injury. Arthritis can do it, and another thing could do it that I never want you to be a part of. If somebody, like a nurse, improperly places an intramuscular gluteal injection, in other words, if you put the needle in the buttocks in the wrong place, you could accidentally stab the sciatic nerve. And if you do, the patient will never forgive you because you may give them either temporary or permanent paralysis, numbness, tingling, pain, and their lawyer will know about it too. And you will learn in the nursing program, for example, how to do it properly. And you're going to do it using anatomy. You will learn certain landmarks, including the greater trochanter. And by knowing your anatomical landmarks, you will put the buttocks injection in the right place and you will not ding their sciatic nerve. It's extremely annoying. If you've had it, you know what I mean. And it reminds me of a true story. When Hurricane Ivan came through, it ripped a bunch of shingles off our roof. And I wanted to save a few bucks, so I thought I'd get up there and do it myself. So I told my wife I was going up on the roof to fix the shingles, and she told me, don't get up on the roof. You have no skill set to do that. So what did I do? I went up on the roof, of course. And to make a long story short, in the process, I crushed my sciatic nerve. I was paralyzed in one lower extremity for 2 months. Had enough medical bills where I could have re-roofed the whole thing probably 3 times over. We'll talk about the fibular nerve next. The fibular nerve shown here beautifully winding around the fibula. And what I want you to know is there's not a whole lot of meat between the outside world and the fibula. I'm not telling you to do this, but if you were to put your hand on the lateral part of your leg, I mean, there's just not a whole lot of meat there between the bone and the outside world. It's easy to injure that fibular nerve. And if you do, it produces a condition called foot drop or numbness because that nerve controls the foot. And people who have fibular nerve injury, when they walk, their foot kind of slaps down to the ground because they don't have control over those muscles. Where you might see this is in a situation that might come up in the ER. I'll give you an example. Person comes in, Mr. Jones comes in, he has a broken leg, and you say, no problem, Mr. Jones, I'll fix you up, put a cast on your leg, come back in 6 weeks and see me. He comes back in 6 weeks, you do the x-ray, the bone's healed perfectly, you take the cast off, and you say, Mr. Jones, bone's healed great. Go on your way. You're doing fantastic. And he says, well, I'm glad the x-ray looked beautiful, but I can't feel or move my foot. Why? Because you put the cast on too tight. That has happened. You can Google it if you want to. If a cast is on too tight, it can crush and damage the fibular nerve right against the bone. Before we leave spinal nerves, I want to talk about something very important called dermatomes. Let's break down the word first. Derma, like dermatitis or dermatologist, means skin. Tome means slice. What is a dermatome? It literally is a slice of skin. a band or an area of skin that is innervated by, that means supplied by, a single spinal nerve. Or the trigeminal nerve for the face. But put that in sort of parentheses, because we're going to do the trigeminal nerve separately when we get to the brain chapter. So just tuck that comment off to the side for now. What's the purpose of knowing about this? Well, let's look at the figure off to your left. It shows a front and a back view of a human being. And each one of these colored and labeled bands shows you which spinal nerve supplies the sensory innervation to that little segment. So that what? So that you can determine maybe what region of the spinal cord is damaged by looking at the pattern of numbness over the dermatome region. In English, what does that mean? I'll give you an example. Let's say you're the doctor, and I come to you and I say, "Doctor, my leg, it's numb. Help me, you're the doctor." So what do? You get out your black bag and you get out a pen. And you start taking that pen and you say, "Can you feel me now? Can you feel me now? Can you feel me now? Can you feel me now?" And he says, "No, no, no, yes, yes, yes," or something like that. And you say, "Okay, I'll be right back." Did you ever notice the doctor often leaves the room? When the doctor leaves the room, here's a little secret. Now, don't tell anybody I told you this. The doctor's leaving the room because he or she doesn't know. So the doctor can't remember everything. So the doctor goes back in his office and takes a look at this map that he has up on the wall and says, "Oh, well, the patient was numb down here and they were okay over there," or whatever. So you go back in the room all real smart and everything. And you say, "Oh, Mr. Jones, you were numb over the distribution of spinal nerves L4 and L5. I think we're going to have to get an MRI scan of your lower spinal cord to see what's going on." So that's what really happens. Okay, this concept is really important. There is what we call overlap. In other words, there's redundancy built into the system. What this first bullet point says is, in the distribution, for example, of dermatome labeled T2, sensation in T2 is also partially supplied by T1 and T3, so that to become completely numb in this band labeled T2, someone would actually have to injure spinal nerves T1, T2, and T3 because they overlap. There's redundancy built into the system. So we could use that knowledge to help people. Remember, you're taking this course not just to get an A. You're taking this course because you want to help people. Here's an example of a patient I saw. I saw a patient with metastatic prostate cancer. Let's say to the rib right here in the distribution of spinal nerve T2. He was in excruciating pain. Even the morphine drip would not take away the pain. He had only about 2 months to live. So what do we tell Mr. Jones? Do we say, "I'm sorry, Mr. Jones, you're going to spend the last 2 months of your life in excruciating pain. There's nothing we can do about it"? No, you use this knowledge and you help him. You may have heard of this being done. Since you know about the dermatomes and about the sensory supply and the overlap, you can take them into the operating room, get a syringe full of anesthetic, and you can inject the anesthetic over the back roots. Remember, the posterior roots are the sensory roots. You numb the back roots of T1, T2, and T3, and he therefore will be completely numb in the band of skin labeled T2 where the tumor was. Alternatively, you could do surgery. there's a surgical procedure. It's called a dorsal rhizotomy. Dorsal means back. Rhizo, if you're a plant person, means root. Otomy means cut. You could go in that same patient, if you wanted to numb him in T2, you cut the back roots, the posterior roots of spinal nerves, T1, T2, and T3, and you will make him completely numb in the distribution of T2 where that tumor is. Why are we cutting the back roots? You got to remember, that's the sensory root. You don't want to cut the anterior root because you paralyze the person. The point isn't to paralyze them. The point is to numb them. That's how this concept is extremely important and useful in the real world. We'll now talk about one of the functions. Earlier on in this unit, we talked about the functions of the spinal cord and spinal nerves. And spinal reflexes are one of the major functions of the spinal nerves and spinal cord. What are they by definition? They are fast, automatic, unplanned sequence of events. Why? You should write down here, to protect us. And why are these called spinal reflexes? Because the processing, the integration, takes place in the spinal cord gray matter. Remember, the gray matter, those are the neurons. Those are the nerve cells. The butterfly, remember, has a little brain. It could do a little thinking, a little bit of processing in this topic we call a spinal reflex. This is the general intro slide, and it lists the five general components of a reflex arc. You've got to know this backwards and forwards, not just for real life, but for the test as well. I've asked it 1,000 times. So let's go through it. The five steps are in order. Number one, some sensory receptor somewhere will be stimulated, which will lead to step number two. A sensory neuron in blue will be excited, and it will send that sensory nerve signal into, of course, the posterior root, and it will go into the back of the butterfly, where step number three will take place. In the butterfly, we have the processing called integration. The butterfly will decide what to do with the sensory information. The butterfly will then put out step number four of the reflex arc, which is shown here in red as a motor signal. That motor signal will go to place number five in the reflex arc, the place you get the effect that some genius called the effector. We will take a look at a series of four different spinal reflexes. They have the same five steps in the same order. I know it will be repetitive, but that's one way of learning and memorizing things. First reflex we'll look at is called the stretch reflex. We'll do the words first, then the picture second. The stretch reflex senses muscle length. In other words, there are stretch receptors in here that sense the length of our muscle cells. Why? Because if you overstretch them, you can damage them. You can ruin them. So again, this reflex is to protect us. This reflex is an example of what we're going to call an ipsilateral reflex. Ipsi means same, lateral means side. This means that both the sensory part of the arc and the motor part of the arc are on the same side. The right leg will sense something, the right leg will move. Every reflex we talk about in this course, except one, is ipsilateral. Last bullet point. Oh boy, big words. In this reflex and every reflex, write it down, there is always reciprocal innervation of the antagonist muscle group. Oh boy, what does that mean in English? It means the opposite muscle group does the opposite thing. In all our reflexes in this course we talk about, we're only going to be using the quadriceps and the hamstrings. And in any reflex we talk about, if the quads are contracting, the hamstrings have to relax. And if the hammies are contracting, the quads better be relaxing. Otherwise, the leg's not going to move and the reflex not going to happen. So all this means is the opposite muscle group does the opposite thing or the reflex won't work. Let's run through this one step at a time. And I've put little green bubbles around each of the steps. So let's say in this example, you go to the doctor and the doctor takes the hammer. And he or she hammers on the patellar ligament. What is really happening when the doctor is hammering on the patellar ligament? Well, picture this as the hammer going in and sort of indenting and stretching that ligament, which will therefore stretch the tendon and the muscle fibers in the quadriceps. So banging this hammer here actually stretches and lengthens the muscle fibers in the quads. So that's step number one. When you bang with the hammer, boom, number one is sensory receptor stimulated. The stretch receptor that senses muscle length is stimulated. Step number two then happens. Sensory neuron in blue is excited. It carries its signal in the back into the butterfly where step number three occurs called integration or processing. And the butterfly says, well, I don't want to ruin my muscles. I don't want to rip them and stretch them. So let me do something about it. And it sends out step number four in red, which is the motor signal. Let's look first at the top motor signal. In a solid red line is an excitatory signal, which goes to place number five, which is the place we get the effect called the effector, in which case we are now exciting the quadriceps. If the quadriceps contract, what happens? The leg kicks out. And that's why when someone hammers on the patellar ligament, the leg kicks out. Notice also in this reflex, the butterfly also sends out another red motor signal. Here shown as a dashed line, it's an inhibitory motor signal going to the opposite muscle group, which is the hammies, and it tells the hammies to relax. Because as the quads are contracting, the hammies better be relaxing. The opposite muscle group always does the opposite thing. That way the reflex happens really good and really fast. Okay, who cares? Some of you are saying, all right, I can learn, you know, the steps of the reflex arc. But, you know, who cares? You know, I'll whip out the hammer. I'll make another $20 on the console. But big deal. No, you're doing this to try to help people. Because if the reflex is not normal, three general things should be broken that I want you to circle on this slide. If they have an abnormal reflex, either something's wrong with the muscles, and you could do a muscle test like an EMG, or something's wrong with the wires, the nerves. And you could do a nerve conduction velocity test, for example. Or number three, something's wrong with the spinal cord, and you could sure get an MRI scan of that. So that's why you're checking the reflex. The next reflex is called the tendon reflex. Let's do the words first. The tendon reflex senses muscle tension. I like that because tendon and tension sound the same. Why is this reflex happening? All this bullet point says is to protect us. If we sense too much tension in our tendons, we want to do something to protect us so we don't damage our muscles or tendons. This is another example of an ipsilateral reflex. That means The right leg is going to sense something, and the right leg is going to move. And point four, you say always, always, always. The opposite muscle group is going to do the opposite thing. Let's take a look at it. In this example, let's say I'm on my universal gym at home, and I take my right leg, and I put that foam cushion deal hooked up to the weights, and I'm trying to lift, say, 200 pounds up and out with my right leg. And that leads to step number one, which is sensory receptor stimulated, because there is a tension receptor in the tendon. And it's saying, I'm sensing a lot of tension. I'm going to send out a sensory signal in blue along a sensory neuron, which is step number two, which delivers its signal into the butterfly for processing, which is step number three, called integration. And the butterfly says, hey man, you're trying to lift out too much weight there. We better drop that back down or we're going to hurt something. So the butterfly sends out step number four in red, which is a motor signal. Notice there's two motor signals. One on the top now is a dashed inhibitory motor signal to the quads that tells the quads to relax and let the weights back down. At the same time, look what the butterfly does too. Another motor signal, solid red excitatory motor signal that goes to the hammies that tells the hammies to contract. And if I contract the hammies, remember that flexes the leg at the knee. So if we relax the quads and contract the hammies, man, we're going to swing that leg back quick and we're going to drop those weights to the floor to protect ourselves. Next reflex is called the flexor reflex. And I like the name because you're going to guess maybe something's going to flex, right? Why is this going to happen? Again, to protect us. Bullet point number two, all it says is it's a really big reflex. It involves a lot of muscle groups and lots of different segments of the spinal cord. This is another one of our same-sided reflexes. Means the right leg is going to sense and the right leg is going to move. And yes, even though your book doesn't show it, there's always reciprocal innervation. You bet the opposite muscle group is going to be doing the opposite thing. So let's do the reflex. Here we go. Going to take my right foot. I'm going to step on attack. Yeah, that's sensory receptor stimulated. Or let's make it worse. I'm driving my foot into a big rusty nail. That sends out step number two in blue. Sensory neuron gets excited, sends its signal through the back root into the butterfly where step number three occurs, the integration, the processing. Leads to step number four, which is a motor signal in red. And the motor signal, in this case, shown as a solid red excitatory signal, is going to the place we get the effect. You guessed it, the effector. In this case, the hammies. And when the hammies contract, again, they flex your leg. And that's going to pull my foot. It's going to withdraw it off that nail or off that tack so I don't drive my foot all the way through it. The final reflex we'll talk about is called the crossed extensor reflex. I like the name. It tells you something's going to cross and something's going to extend. So let's break it down. This reflex helps maintain balance during the flexor reflex. Look, guys, if I flex my right leg, what better my left leg do? Okay, I know that's not proper English, but you know what I'm saying. What better my left lower limb do or else I fall down? It better extend, right? I mean, if I flex my right leg and then flex my left leg at the same time, I fall down. This is our only example of a contralateral reflex. That means opposite side reflex. It means the sensory and motor impulses are going to be on opposite sides. We'll see in this example, the right leg is going to sense something, the left leg is going to move. Is there reciprocal innervation of the antagonist muscle group? You know the answer is yes, always. Pencil it in one more time. Even though your book does not show it here. So let's do it one at a time. Step number one, I step on the nail with my right foot. That's sensory receptor stimulated. Step number two, in blue, sensory neuron excited, which carries that signal into the posterior root, in towards the back of the butterfly, where step number three occurs, called integration. That's the processing. And look what happens here. The butterfly sends a signal across to the other side of the spinal cord, to the left side of the cord, where it then shoots out step number four, motor signal, shown as a solid red excitatory signal that goes to the effector, which is the quadriceps of the opposite leg, that is the left leg. If I contract my quads, I extend my leg. Notice, your book doesn't show it again, but there are inhibitory signals being sent to the hamstrings at the same time. You know that as the quads are contracting, the hammies are relaxing. This is one of those embedded animations again, so take a look at those. This is just a summary slide to let you know that we didn't cover every reflex in the human body. I don't want you to leave this course thinking, oh, I know all the reflexes, Dr. Gonshore, he told us all about them. No, these are only four reflexes. These are only somatic reflexes. In other words, they only involve skeletal muscles. And they were only spinal reflexes. And they only involved the quads and the hammies. There's lots of other ones. There's cranial reflexes. There's autonomic reflexes, like your pupil constricting to light, for example. So there's all kind of reflexes. We only did four of them. This slide here is beautiful. It's a wonderful summary of pretty much everything we've done in this unit so far. I know to some of you it may look overwhelming or too busy. And you know what? If it does, just crumple it up and throw it out. But for some of you, this may be working very nicely. This really puts together a lot of the anatomy and physiology, all concise in one slide. So if it helps you, look at it, work with it, marvel at it. If you think it's too much, throw it out. There's really nothing new on this slide. Before we end this segment, I want to talk about a couple of disorders of the spinal cord and spinal nerves. This is not a disease course, but I want to tell you about a few things for interest's sake. The only one I want you to know for my course, for sure, is spinal cord transection. So in the figure, here we have the melon, here we have the cord, and if an injury severs the cord like this, watch the animated PowerPoint, boom, you need to know that an injury like that is going to cause loss of sensation and loss of motor function below the level of the injury. You possibly already knew that before you took this course, but now I want all of you to know that. You know, why does this happen? I mean, because no sensory information below the transection can get up to the brain, and no motor information can get down past the transection from the brain. So that's why we lose all motor and sensory below the level of the transection. There's a disease called neuritis. All that means is inflammation of nerves. It can be from all kinds of things, injuries, vitamin deficiencies, or poisons. Shingles is interesting to talk about. What shingles really is just the chicken pox virus coming back later in life. If anybody like me has ever had chicken pox, it doesn't die. It actually lays dormant in a part of the nervous system called the dorsal root ganglion. It just kind of hangs out there. And as our immune system gets weak, either with age or with due to drugs or diseases or immunosuppressants or HIV, the virus says, oh, nothing's keeping me in check anymore. I'm coming back out. And it comes back out exactly along the spinal nerves that are hooked to that root and breaks out in a perfect patch of blisters and discoloration and pain in the distribution of a dermatome. Perfectly, just like that map I showed you of the dermatome man. Once you see a case of shingles, you'll never forget it. The blisters look the same, always breaks out in the perfect patches of the dermatome. Sometimes they get infected with bacteria on top of that. They smell sometimes. They tend to be very painful. The chance of getting shingles, by the way, they say is equal to your age. I know there's a vaccine out now that's designed to hopefully prevent chickenpox and shingles later in life. Some people who have shingles end up with a very painful form of it. I think the number is about 20% of people with shingles get the painful kind. So painful that pain medications can barely touch it. And those patients actually have been known to become suicidal. So be aware of this in your patients with shingles. Polio, of course, mostly this is a thing of the past. But the polio virus tends to get in the anterior horns and sometimes the lateral gray horns. What it does there, of course, is damage them, and those people end up paralyzed or maybe even end up dying from cardiac or respiratory arrest. So, yes, this stuff is real stuff. I hope you enjoyed this unit, and we'll have part 3 coming up next.